Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
You are listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn. Welcome to episode 268 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature highly acclaimed actor, playwright, and lyricist, among other things, David Kale. We have a really wonderful conversation with David regarding his journey from England to the West Village and ultimately to Broadway, and of course, a few points in between. We focus a bit on his present day project, a really excellent one according to most all critics. Right now he has a one-man show at the Minetta Lane Theater in New York City, of course, called Harry Clark, which features the great Tony Award-winning actor Billy Crudup. We also discuss a little bit of philosophy regarding art and the human experience. I think you'll enjoy it. David Kale today on the program. We also have an EWSA by yours truly called Still, and our associate producer once again has crafted a very poignant and introspective piece titled Kiss Today Goodbye. Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, will be sharing that. We also have a poem called Hooray! And of course, as is always the case, all of this will be infused with the brilliant energy of several great tunes. Thanks for being here. Let's get to it. Episode 268 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
That's life.
That's life.
That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shot down in May. But I know I'm gonna change that tune. When I'm back on top in June. I said that's life. And as funny as it may seem, some people get their kicks stomping on a dream. But I don't let it get me down. 'Cause this fine old world, it keeps spinning around. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out. And I know one thing, each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life.
That's life.
I tell you, I can't deny it. I thought of quitting, baby, but my heart just ain't gonna buy it. And if I didn't think it was worth one single try, I'd jump right on a big bird and then I'd fly. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out. And I know one thing, each time I find myself laying flat on my face, I just pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life.
That's life.
And I can't deny it.
thought of cutting out, but my heart won't buy it. But if there's nothing shaking come this here July, I'm gonna roll myself up in a big ball and die. My, my.
Still, from a series called Stop Being a Robot. This is part one. Happiness can be directly correlated with a community's sense of justice and merit-based opportunity. Conversely, if a community is plagued by corruption, small-mindedness, nepotism, the so-called crab bucket effect, and other similar types of human approaches to living, those folks feel like shit more often than not. Couple that with long periods of overcast weather patterns, and you end up with high levels of despair, drug and alcohol abuse, bad eating, domestic dysfunction, etc. My neck of the woods is of these tendencies from institution to institution, family to neighborhood to government to workplace. Is yours too? If so, what can one do? And if not, please share. What can one do? We all talk about living right, being good. So how, though, can such despairing circumstances in society still be prevalent? Who and what is right? How do we define and actually live good lives? It is my understanding some of the places on earth with the highest recorded so-called happiness indexes are found in Scandinavia and also in relatively insulated villages across the globe, where the sun shines perhaps a bit more on the lobes. Why not in my town, my state, my country? Life is too precious and short to get lost in a vortex of self-inflicted pain via a mistaken cultural outlook in the pursuit of greater and greater material gain. And here we are still, just the same. We'll be right back.
Hello,
David Kale. Is that you?
It is I.
Hi, it's C.W. Conundrum from Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program, sir.
I'm happy to be on the program.
Well, before we get started, let me share a little background information for the listeners. Here we go. David Kale, playwright, actor, lyricist, among other things. David wrote the book, lyrics, co-composed the music, and played Floyd in his musical Floyd and Clea Under the Western Sky at the Goodman Theater. David has also written for the stage the solos Lillian, Somebody Else's House, Deep in a Dream of You, Smooch Music, and the Red Throats. Floyd and Clea Under the Western Sky went on to run in New York at Playwrights Horizons, receiving an Outer Critics Circle nomination for Outstanding New Off-Broadway Musical. Lillian also ran at Playwrights Horizons, receiving an Obie Award, and Deep in a Dream of You ran at the Public Theater, receiving a Bessie Award for Outstanding Creative Achievement. Lillian was also recorded live for National Public Radio's This American Life. David has written lyrics for songs sung by artists including Debbie Harry and Elvis Costello. As an actor, Mr. Kale's films and television credits include The Slaughter Rule, Pollock, and The Good Wife. He has performed in plays on Broadway and off, most recently The Total Bent at the Public Theater. A work in progress of We're Only Alive for a Short Amount of Time was recently part of the 2018 Under the Radar Festival at the Public Theater. His newest solo work, Harry Clark, starring Billy Crudup, one of my favorites, premiered off-Broadway at the Vineyard Theater and is currently running at the Minetta Lane Theater. Ladies and gentlemen, David Kale. I don't know if we have any more time now after that intro to talk, but hopefully. Pretty impressive, sir.
Thank you.
And I'd like to get right in by asking you a question about how you came into writing and acting. How did you end up where you are as an artist, writing and acting?
I started singing when I was a teenager with a rock band in England called Cold Eye Driver, and like a little local rock band. And then I started singing in pubs and did a little bit of sort of busking on the street, but singing other people's songs. And then when I moved to America, I was singing in different clubs, but always other people's songs. And I realized it just wasn't working for me. It wasn't the songs, while they were very good songs, they weren't as resonant for me emotionally as I needed the songs to be. And it wasn't something that was getting a very strong response from an audience. So I set myself a deadline to write a batch of three songs in a month and accompany myself on the guitar, which I didn't play the guitar. So I bought a guitar, and I managed to sketch out these three songs, and I performed them at Folk City, which was a legendary folk club in the West Village in New York City that had this open mic on a Monday night, basically. So, and a friend of mine was in the audience, and he said, "I think the lyrics are better than the melodies. Go to the St. Mark's Poetry Project and read them. They have like an open mic one night a month or whatever it was." Mm-hmm. And I read them, the lyrics, as like mini monologues. And then somebody there said, "Take them to Westbed Theater in the West Village, and they have an evening of performance exploration." And before I knew it, these songs evolved into monologues, which, and then I started writing stories that got more and more dramatic. And before I knew it, I was doing these sort of one-person shows. It was very organic, the way the whole thing evolved. And then I went back to adding songs and adding live music to the monologues and ultimately making these sort of music theater pieces and musicals and still doing the solo shows alongside. And then acting evolved from people seeing me in my own show, asking me to audition for things or asking me to be in things. And then I started acting. I started initially in films. I didn't do a play for many years. I'd done quite a few little parts in films, but I hadn't been in a play. And then in the mid-90s, I did a whole slew of plays, almost back-to-back, I think half a dozen of them. So I was going between acting and going between my own work and acting, and sometimes writing lyrics for different singers, and it was a pretty eclectic mix of things. And then I sort of dipped into writing for dance companies. And I like to do a wide variety of things.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun, quite frankly.
It is. It's a lot of fun, especially some of the collaborations, like working with people that I'm excited by, and especially with singers, or right now with Harry Clarke, with Billy Crudup, and Lee Silverman directing. It's like these exciting collaborations are really thrilling. Are really thrilling for me.
So. Oh, and Harry Clarke is getting some, or has gotten some really great reviews, both for the writing, the staging, and of course for Billy Crudup's portrayal of the character. Characters, I should say, and you know, that must be exciting for you.
It's really thrilling because I wanted Lee Silverman to direct it, and I wanted Billy Crudup to be in it, and they both miraculously, because it came together very, very quickly. They were both available, or they made themselves available, and they wanted to do it, and. I mean, they wanted to do it first, and then they made themselves available. Both of them have a lot going on, so there's a lot of finessing of schedules. But the two people that I wanted to work on it are doing it, so it's really thrilling. And there were many nights when we started, I still couldn't believe I was watching Billy perform my show because I just wanted him so badly, and then he's doing it, and I didn't know him personally before, so it was quite disorienting in a very exciting way to actually see the person you dreamed of being in this role is in the role. And it was the first show that I performed, that I hadn't performed in also, so there was that. I'd never written a solo show that somebody else had performed. I'd performed all myself. So I'd never been in the audience with. So the whole thing has been really thrilling. And Lee, it's so deeply directed by Lee. And the design is so carefully thought out that it feels like the perfect sort of physical production as well. And what Lee has done with Billy, this collaboration that they have, is really extraordinary. They're still working on it. It's not like it suddenly got frozen and they're still mining it, and they'll be in his dressing room and for 20 minutes, like adding things. And I added some things to the script just a couple of weeks ago. So it's still very much a living thing.
And it's running
and
present.
He's getting better and better.
Oh, yes, I'm sure of it. I mean, he must love what you've written, and working with Lee, of course, as well, directing him. It's at the Minetta Lane Theater right now, and it'll be there for a few more weeks, I understand.
Yeah, it's there, I think, until May 13th.
May 13th, great. So yeah. People have time still.
Billy's really committed to it. Because we ran at the Vineyard Theater for as long as we could run, and then, of course, they have another show coming in. Billy held his schedule till we could find theater. There was no theaters available initially. But Billy has been very committed to it and just hung in there till a theater became available. And then we jumped into production again very quickly at Minetta Lane.
Well, let me ask you a question about, I want to get, because time goes by so quickly in our conversations. I want to make sure I get to certain things. I do appreciate your time. The potential of going off on a tangent in so many different, with so many interesting ideas is so likely. I've come to get a little bit better at it. But
Here we go. How did you come into writing and acting, we asked you about? Now I want to know a little deeper, what aspects of human existence do you find yourself revisiting in your work?
Many of the shows or the monologues or the songs are about romantic relationships. And they sort of, the inner lives of people in romantic settings. And a lot of the pieces are very peppered with people's thoughts as they're going through situations with another person. And so that's definitely something I come back to, like romance and desire crop up many, many times in my work.
Well, those are the eternal struggles and joys, I suppose, right? Both. That's why, yeah, it resonates, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's the thing that's always sort of captivated me.
And
so
Harry Clark is no different?
Harry Clark's a bit different. I mean, with Harry, I very consciously wanted to see if I could write as close as I could get to a one-man thriller. So there was, it's a different kind of story. I mean, it's one long story, as opposed to many of my shows are pieces assembled, almost like an album. Like there'll be like sort of 10 or 12 monologues or stories, and they sort of sequence more like an album than anything else. But this one was more, it's more of, I think I was hoping for something that had more of the tension of a thriller, and you didn't quite know where it was going to go, or whether to completely trust the narrator. So it's a bit different. It's a bit different all around.
A thriller in the sense that is Harry like on the edge, ready to lose it, or to find something, or both?
Harry. The thing about the show is, I mean, it's somebody from the Midwest. It's a very timid guy from the Midwest who can do a really good English accent. And he's much freed up, much more like uninhibited as playing this persona of a Cockney by the name of Harry Clark. And he moves to New York and presents himself as an English person. He's not. And then at one particular moment slips into this character of Harry Clark in New York City. And that, so it, his life sort of makes a sudden left turn as this other person. So he is deceiving people in a very kind of film noir-y way. So that's a very different thing to anything I've ever done before. And it does have the element of the, is he going to commit a crime? Is he going to do something terrible?
And
running through it.
So he is on the edge.
But on the other hand, he's really likable, and especially with in Billy's hands, because Billy is so charismatic and such a magnetic person. And when Billy smiles, I mean, it's like he's got that, I don't know, it's that Julia Roberts thing. It's
right.
Like this kind of magnetic movie star glow that he has.
Oh, he does.
That is very disarming. And so he's very charming with Harry, too, which is what I wanted. So it's not straightforward. I think people are on Harry's side because, I mean, I feel that with the audiences, that they're sort of going along with him. But really, you don't quite know what Harry's going to do.
It sounds like a thriller. That's wonderfully explained. Thank you, David Kale. Appreciate it. Let me ask you another question. When you are trying to make ends meet over the years, maybe now, maybe at this moment, it's easier. How challenging is it to make ends meet as a writer, as an actor?
I don't think the challenge of it's ever gone away. And there's periods, because I've been doing it full time for since 1985, that there's periods where it gets really scary, and there's periods where, you know, it's like any kind of longer term career. There's periods where there's a lot of stuff going on, and then there's periods almost directly alongside where there's nothing happening. And I know I've sampled both, and I certainly know what it's like when things completely grind to a halt. But the it does get to a point. Well, it did with me, because I can't really do anything. I don't have any skills to offer the world that are very useful. And when I was, the job that I had was, I worked in a mailroom for 5 years, and I worked in a record store before that for years. And it's like, what do I do? I don't know what I would do if this does actually grind to a halt. So then there's that fear is, doesn't really go away. I mean, right now there's really wonderful things going on, and it's a very exciting time for me personally, but the, and with what, with my work, but it's, you know, I know that things can change very quickly for the good or bad with in this kind of territory, that it could suddenly in a few months be really quiet again. It's like flying without a net, that's for sure. But I sort of hang in there. It's the only thing I know how to do, and I love it. You know, it drives me crazy, and I love it. It's a long term relationship.
Yeah, well put, well put. Many of the artists that I talk with for the program say something similar. Really, like, there's nothing else that I want to do. Nothing else that I really think I could do, and this is who I am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is when there's been periods, not so long ago, where I thought, what am I going to do? And thankfully, Harry Clark has stepped in and is saving the day, at least for now. But the,
You are listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a question in another area that you've excelled in. Well, writing songs for people like Debbie Harry and Elvis Costello, two amazing artists, in my opinion. How did that happen? And what songs actually have you had something to do with those artists?
I was working with this band called the Jazz Passengers.
Oh,
who
yeah.
Were,
sure.
I did this show called Smooch Music that I basically had half of the Jazz Passengers were playing. Roy Nathanson wrote the music, and he co-leads the Jazz Passengers with Curtis Folks. And then in 95, I think it was, Hal Wilner, this great album producer, was going to produce an album of Jazz Passengers originals that would have vocals. And on each track would be a different singer. And I was asked to write some of the lyrics for the album. And I wrote for a song for Jimmy Scott, the great, great Jimmy Scott.
Yeah, yeah.
And Debbie was on the record. A performance, John Kelly, a fabulous performance artist, and Freddie Johnston. There was a whole, Mavis Staples was on the record, Jeff Buckley. It was a really eclectic mix of wonderful, wonderful people. And the album was quite a success, and the band needed to tour with a singer who could do all these different styles and had a sense of humor and a wit and vocally could pull it off. And they asked Debbie Harry, who Blondie was not active at that moment. And so Debbie started touring with them as the lead singer. And Elvis Costello heard the record, I would assume via Hal. And Elvis liked the record and started singing the songs with the Jazz Passengers. So these were all Jazz Passengers songs that they were singing of mine. But but Elvis has sung, I think, three of them live, and Debbie's sung quite a few and has recorded, I think, five or six of them. But that's, I mean, to be in the audience and hear the two of them, that's one of the high points of my artistic life. And being in the studio with Jimmy Scott was heaven. I mean, some of these, because I'm such a music geek to begin with, these are people I've admired for years, and to actually hear my lyrics being sung by them is beyond the beyond. It's so thrilling to me.
Yeah, I could hear it in your voice, and for me too. If that, you know, that's just hard to even imagine being in the audience. It has to be a bit surreal.
It really is. And there was one concert that they did in England at the Royal Festival Hall, and I went over there to see it because I grew up in England, and this venue meant so much to me. And it was packed. And Debbie and Elvis were, it was largely Debbie with the passengers, and Elvis came on and sang two of his songs. It was like a guest spot. It was transcendent. They were incredible. They were in such great voice, too. And the audience went nuts, and I went nuts. It was heaven.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. Again, David Kale on the program, Troubadours and Rock on Tours. A pleasure having you on. Playwright, actor, lyricist, artist, generally speaking. A couple of more minutes we have. I'd like to ask a couple more questions, if you don't mind. Let's see here. Now, we're talking about some of your stage productions, and you know, you're an actor too. You've acted in TV, film, on stage for your monologues in particular. Pollock, I saw. Is that the movie about the artist?
Yeah.
Was that Ed Harris?
It was Ed Harris directed it. Yes.
Yeah. I
played Pollock.
Yeah, I saw that. You were in that flick.
I'm in that flick.
Wow.
What a part.
Yeah,
I'm proud to be part of that film.
Yeah, that's a great film. Great film. Now, how would you compare? You said you started on film. In film, how would you compare being on stage in a live setting as to you know, being an artist in the context of you know, the big screen and trying to capture something, an energy for the big screen?
Yeah, I seem to be the only one that thinks this, but I think acting in films is much harder than acting on stage. For me, it is, at least. Because I grew up, I'm so immersed in music and movies all my life. So movies meant a great deal to me, and it was always, I was like such a movie fan. But just how to act in the movie, I mean, to be absolutely relaxed and also ready to, you have to be ready to change everything on a dime. Anything that you've prepared, it has to be, you have to be so flexible. And also there's so much waiting around with most movies, and you can literally be sitting in a room for 17 hours waiting to start, and then suddenly they come in and say, okay, we're going. That springing into action thing, and being absolutely relaxed, because the camera picks up on tension in a way that I feel like the stage can kind of absorb it. But I find it much more challenging, but it's really the thing that I prefer acting in films than acting on stage, outside my own work.
But you find it harder to act in film than on stage.
But I find it harder. I find it might be because I don't do it very often. I think if I did it constantly, I think you get into a friend of mine is a film director, and she said, like, she was talking about actors that she worked with, and she said the thing about them is they're in such great shape because they do it all the time. They can really access you. If you ask them to break down, they can break down. You know, it's just they're very fluid with this because they're doing it all the time. And I think it's a little bit like athletics, mm-hmm. that or just exercise, that if because I, you know, I erratically do it. So it's like I have to kind of start up again in a way. And there's certain things like remembering lines. I think when you're doing it all the time, you don't worry about that, but I'll tend to worry. I'm going to forget the lines and derail the scene.
There's more time to worry, I suppose, because you're sitting around waiting, whereas on stage,
yeah,
it's just...
Yeah, yeah,
you're going. You're on. That's it.
You're just going. And, you know, I just worked on a film where several scenes were shot in one take. It was a seven-minute take. And I come into the camera just following the leads from a van to a bill, getting crossing a parking lot into a building, getting on an elevator, coming out of the elevator, and then running into me. And I have to say a few lines. And I was so afraid that I was going to forget the lines or scramble something, and it derailed this gigantically ambitious shot. That kind of a thing. You don't get that in the theater. We get other, there's other challenges, great challenges in the theater. Not to say that theater is easy.
No.
It just certainly is not. But I don't know, the pressure is really on. Plus, you can sometimes you only get to do it once in a movie, and, you know, that's it. I mean, oftentimes you don't, it's more than once. But, you know, I've certainly done things in films where I did one take, and that's what's in the film.
Yeah, it's like the old jazz musicians. They say, we're doing this once or twice, and I think it was Thelonious Monk used to tell his musicians, if you mess up the second time, that's it. You're going to have to live with it because it's going to be printed and it's there for eternity.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. It's like that with movies. I mean, that's what they remind me. Making an album, making a movie feel related to me, in my head at least. I mean, just that thing, it's like capturing that spontaneity. And when it works, fantastic.
Yeah,
but you know, if it's wonky and you don't get it, you don't get it. Movies move on. You know, they'll be shooting the next scene, and you're just kicking yourself and that you just did it wrong. You know, you could have done it better. That kind of scenario, which with the theater, you can maybe fix it the next night or try and fix it the next night, the next performance. But with the movies, that's it.
Beautiful. Great. Great comparison. Well, we have time for just one more question, Mr. Keel, and that is, what is the importance of stage productions for you as a person, and art in general? Let's just put it that, art in general, for you as a person and for humanity in general. So what's the importance of art in society for you as a person and for humanity in general?
Oh my God, that's such a complicated question.
You have 90 seconds.
I have 90
no,
seconds.
I'm just kidding.
To fix the world.
Yeah. Through art.
You know, the thing that I want from theater and music and movies partly is to have a greater sense of being alive and to be make me feel fully alive, or make me realize something that I hadn't known before, whether it be personal or something of the world. But that's a very complicated question to answer in 30 seconds.
Yeah, unfair. Unfair, for sure. But
brutal.
But I think you shared a great answer. I mean, it makes sense to me. And you know, you are obviously a very talented individual, and I'm very happy and, may I say, honored that you were on Troubadours and Rock on Tours, and I look forward to more of your work in the future, David Keel.
Oh, thank you very much. Really a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you, sir. When they told me that the sign
just to say it. Oh, I know she's disgusted.
Oh, why's that?
Cause she's feeling so abused.
Oh, that's too bad.
She gets tired. Say that I'm too old when angels have stolen my red shoes. Oh, I said I'm so happy I could die. She said drop dead and left with another guy. That's what you get if you go chasing after vengeance. Ever since you got me punctured, this has been my sentence. So I used to be disgusted when I try to be amused.
Kiss today goodbye. One day, a long time ago, I was walking the streets of our depressed former coal town, and I turned onto Wyoming Avenue. The street was blocked off to traffic, and in front of the Globe store, one of our two main department stores, sat the Showmobile, a traveling stage that brought song, dance, and theater to our neighborhoods. On the stage, a man and a woman, local thespians, were singing show tunes and popular songs. At one point in the show, the man sat on a stool and sang What I Did for Love from a chorus line. It was the first time I heard it. When he finished the song, I went right to the record department of the Globe store, that's how long ago this was, and bought the original cast recording. And I've been listening to the show on vinyl, on tape, on CD, in performance, and in my head, ever since. Now, I was no stranger to show tunes when I heard that song. I had grown up on old Hollywood musicals on TV and regularly watched variety shows, from Ed Sullivan on down, which featured much crooning of movie and Broadway standards. At the time, people my age bought Led Zeppelin and Mott the Hoople albums. I purchased cast albums, Pippin, The Wiz, and movie soundtracks, Cabaret, Funny Lady. My mother was a fan of show tunes as well, and would sometimes torment me in the early mornings with my own cast albums, sending Andy's Pay On to Tomorrow, Only Being a Day Away, booming through the upstairs of our house. I listened to a chorus line many times before I saw it on stage, on Broadway, and in touring shows. And as the title aptly states, it's a show about dancers. In particular, dancers auditioning for a Broadway chorus line. So, a musical about a musical, which many musicals are, and have been since the beginning of musicals. In this musical, the dancers tell their life stories to the mostly off-stage director, choreographer auditioning them. During the show, they temporarily leave behind the anonymity of the chorus line and become characters. The characters are based on real dancers, and their stories evolved from workshops conducted by the director, choreographer Michael Bennett. They tell how they became dancers. They tell about their insecurities. They tell about their dysfunctional families, before the word dysfunction was in common use. They tell about their sexuality, their quirks, their fears, their dreams. The creators, Bennett, composer Marvin Hamlisch, lyricist Edward Kleban, book writers James Kirkwood Jr. and Nicholas Dante, forged the dancers' stories into a moving celebration of, and lament for, life in this business called show. As I said, I heard the show before I saw it, a not unusual occurrence, and what especially struck me the first time I put the record on the turntable, and strikes me every time I listen to the score, is the brilliance of Kleban's lyrics. Before his life-changing success with the show, he was a producer at Columbia Records and struggled to become a Broadway composer. The musical about Kleban, written by Linda Klein and Lonnie Price, a class act, features songs he wrote which never made it to the stage. In the musical, there's a song called Friday at Four about the weekly, life-saving musical theater workshop he attended. After Chorus Line opened and transformed musical theater, Kleban was never able to match its success, and he died from throat cancer at 48. In his will, he designated his Chorus Line fortune to fund a foundation that gives grants to promising lyricists and librettists. In A Chorus Line, his lyrics tackle the trials and tribulations of adolescence, Hello 12, Hello 13, the case for plastic surgery made by a career hoofer, Dance 10, Looks 3, the consolations of dance class for unhappy young girls, At the Ballet, the strangeness and cruelty of an acting class, Nothing, and the inescapable impulse to dance, The Music and the Mirror. The final number, 1, is both a study of star quality and specialness, one singular sensation, every little move she makes, and at the same time, a moment for the chorus members to shine, one by one, as they take their bows in gold lame, top hats, and tails. Original costumes by Theona V. Aldridge. His lyrics are slangy and sexy and touching and sentimental and borderline maudlin. His subject is showbiz, after all. They're funny, sad, precise, and character-driven. They encompass pop culture, bad families, neuroses, personal tragedy, and hard-won triumph. The musical is about professionally anonymous types becoming individuals during the show and before your eyes, and Kleban's lyrics perfectly embody the themes of the show. Kiss Today Goodbye, the dancer Diana Morales sings after one of her friends has been injured during a tap sequence and perhaps ended his career. The sweetness and the sorrow. She sings her song in response to a question posed by the choreographer. What do you do when you can't dance anymore? A dancer's career is ephemeral, fruit fly-like in duration, like, well, life. The show is about loss, and the specter of AIDS shadows its history. Many of its makers and original cast members suffered early deaths as the show ran and ran on Broadway. It's about doing what you love while you can, in full knowledge of what looms ahead. It's about going on, again and again and again.
I'm watching Cisco pitter-pat. Said, I can do that, I can do that. Knew every step right off the bat. Said, I can do that, I can do that. One morning, sis won't go to dance class. I grab her shoes and tights and all, but my foot's too small, so I stuff her shoes with extra socks. Run 7 blocks in nothing flat. Hell, I can do that. I can do that. I got to class and had it made, and so I stayed the rest of my life, all thanks to sis. Now married and fat, I can do this. That it can do, I can do that.
Hooray! One man, many aspects of character coiffed through forced parity. One woman, many avenues of charity, despite grave expanses of disparity. And the wind cries nary a moment for either choice of living, taking and giving up until the end, starting from the beginning. Can you see? Can you hear? Can you feel the artistic heart and soul? You are on Shakespeare's noted stage. You are the world's greatest sage. Then into the dirt you lay. So today, hip hip hooray!
Lazing on a sunny afternoon.
And there you have it, episode 268 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, actor, playwright, lyricist, and all-around great guy, David Kale. Thank you so much for being on the show, and a nice hello to the whole cast and crew of Harry Clark. We also like to thank our associate producer and resident essayist, Michael Pavese, the great doctor, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare. And of course, these musical artists, Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Frank Sinatra, the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, Elvis Costello and the Attractions, the 2006 Broadway revival cast of A Chorus Line, our friend Nellie Mackay, and of course, Terrence Blanchard and Branford Marsalis, too. Until next week, enjoy this one. Thanks for listening.